people, if you let them, will tell you what features to build. They will take out a napkin and draw it. They will tell you, I want exactly this feature that your competitor has. I am not disagreeing with that at all. But if I said, if you let them, which is you learn the more you talk to customers to steer people back away from that very specific feature to what the problem is.
Ciao, io sono Marco Imperato e questo è il podcast di Product Heroes. Product Heroes è il punto di riferimento in Italia per il product manager. Finora abbiamo aiutato oltre 180.000 persone tramite master, formazione in azienda, guide, articoli e meetup. Lo facciamo anche attraverso questo podcast in cui intervisto product leader che spaccano e che potranno darti tantissimi consigli utili per migliorare il tuo modo di costruire, lanciare e muovere le metriche del tuo prodotto. Non posso davvero credere all'ospite che abbiamo oggi. In questa puntata avrai il piacere di ascoltare in anteprima assoluta una delle incredibili speaker che ospiteremo alla Product Heroes Conference 2024. Ti ricordo infatti che la Product Heroes Conference è confermata anche per quest'anno, sarà il 3 e il 4 ottobre 2024 a Milano, nella spettacolare location di Super Studio Più. Se ancora non l'hai fatto, ti ricordo che puoi iscriverti in lista d'attesa o comprare già direttamente i biglietti qualora fossero disponibili. Trovi comunque il link in descrizione. L'ospite è Cindy Alvarez, che oggi ricopre il ruolo di Director of User Experience in PowerPoint ed è l'autrice di Lean Customer Development. Uno dei libri che ho più letto in assoluto negli ultimi anni è il libro definitivo per le customer interview. Il mio libro è assolutamente massacrato, pieno di note, appunti e pieghe e davvero non posso credere di aver avuto l'opportunità di parlare con Cindy. Tra l'altro Cindy ha seguito l'implementazione di Copilot, recentissima, un sistema AI di Microsoft, dentro PowerPoint insieme al suo team. La puntata di oggi è dedicata interamente alle customer interview, quindi insieme a Cindy scopriremo come il comportamento dei nostri utenti sia l'elemento principale per ottenere le informazioni di cui abbiamo bisogno, che ci servono a migliorare il nostro prodotto. Parleremo di tools, degli errori da evitare, dei migliori metodi per condurre un'intervista e di come sfruttare al meglio le informazioni raccolte. Capiremo insieme a lei come individuare i nostri utenti, chi può davvero portare i risultati della nostra ricerca, come selezionarli e come portarli a bordo per le nostre interview, fino a delineare una vera e propria guida pratica. Alla fine dell'episodio poi Cindy risponderà anche a tutte le domande fatte dalla community. Se tu dovessi averne qualcuna, non esitare, lasciacelo nei commenti che la riporteremo a Cindy. Insomma, un episodio davvero pazzesco per chi crede che le customer interview siano fondamentali e possano portare un impatto davvero significativo sul proprio prodotto, facendoti risparmiare un sacco di tempo e soldi e soprattutto diluendo il rischio di insuccesso. Se ancora non l'hai fatto, iscriviti al canale su YouTube per rimanere sempre aggiornato sull'uscita dei nostri contenuti. Se invece ci segui in formato podcast, ti chiedo di lasciarci una review con 5 stelle su Spotify o sulla piattaforma su cui ci stai ascoltando. Questo ci aiuterà ad impattare ancora più persone e a diffondere ancora di più la cultura di prodotto in Italia, che poi è la nostra missione. Inoltre, se come capita spesso hai trovato questo podcast perché te l'ha suggerito un amico tramite WhatsApp, Gmail o di persona, fai lo stesso con un altro tuo contatto. Alla fine anche questo è un modo per diffondere la cultura di prodotto in modo super veloce. Adesso non mi resta che augurarti buon ascolto e ricordarti che dopo i tempi duri vengono sempre tempi eroici. Hey Cindy, welcome to Product Heroes.
Hello, thank you for having me.
Thanks for being here. It's very early in US. So what time is it at your place?
8:35.
Okay, cool. I just want to start with the very first and very easy question. So you are the author of one of the Bible on customer development, customer interview. In each edition of our master, we teach the book. My personal copy is like full of notes. And the first question is kind of strange. So customer interviews and customer development to me is one of the most interesting and most powerful tool to mitigate risk. But my question is, why, in your opinion, a lot of companies are still struggling to talk with their users? Which are the blockers, in your opinion?
Yeah. So the biggest blocker to talking with customers is actually that most people don't know how they would find a customer. I mean, if you said, I want to go out, you know, in 2 hours and talk to a customer, where are they? Do I have their contact information? You know, for various either technology or privacy reasons, most of us can't just go in a database and go find an email address and ping someone and be like, hey, can you talk in 20 minutes? And the funny truth is that a lot of people would actually say yes. So I think there's also a perception that you have to have something really good on offer for a customer. Like you have to reward them financially, or you have to give them access to a beta because otherwise they won't want to talk to you. And I find that's really not true. People are very willing to talk about their experiences. And most people, if you make it clear that you're not trying to sell them something or you're not trying to make them feel bad, you're just genuinely curious, will help. But, you know, for example, I work on the PowerPoint team today. Even though people all over the world use PowerPoint, for me to go find one specific person and have their contact info, I mean, I can't just, there's no database in Microsoft where I can just look up a contact information. So I would have to randomly, you know, post on Twitter, post on LinkedIn, ask a friend. And that feels very unscientific, which actually shouldn't stop people either, because a lot of times that's fine. It may not be your perfect target customer, but if someone has used PowerPoint in the last 2 weeks, they probably have something useful I can learn from.
Good. So one of the questions we had from our community was exactly, how do I recruit users? So I know it's very important to talk to users. I know, I kind of know what I'm going to ask them, but can you give us some advice on how to recruit customers? So you were saying customers that are using my product, but if I have to build a new product, what can I do?
Yeah. So if you have to build a new product, you don't have any place for that people are already going, then a lot of this starts from kind of word of mouth and friend of a friend, posting on Facebook, asking someone to forward mails onto you, and thinking about where are your customers already. And I like to think of it as, if you already had a product and you were trying to take out advertising, where would you go? Like, you would probably have a sense of, I should advertise on this website, or I should put a billboard up here, or I should make sure the people in this organization know about it. And that's kind of a start. I think, and again, I said something about, you know, that's not very scientific. I think we have this very high bar in our heads of how we have to find the perfect customer. And it's really not true. Yes, you do need someone who has the same problem. So if I was trying to design something for tracking your weightlifting workouts, it wouldn't do me any good to talk to someone who's never lifted weights and has no interest in doing it. But I wouldn't have to find someone who is super into CrossFit or, you know, working on, you know, increasing their bench press max. I would just have to find anyone who has maybe lifted weights in the last three times in the last month, or who really enjoys doing so. And I feel like I could go to my friends. I could just blast out an email or put a post on LinkedIn and say, hey, I am looking to talk to people with this minimum bar. Right? Like, have you lifted weights 3 times in the last month and you're interested in doing more of it? Great. I'd love to talk to you. And it doesn't have to be perfect.
It's funny what you're saying. So it doesn't have to be perfect. And usually when you want to start customer interviews, you think it's going to be very hard to find people. But at the end of the day, what I discovered is that people want to help and want to help a lot. So it happens sometimes that, as you say, you should keep your interview within 25 minutes, 30 minutes, no more. They want to talk for hours.
Yeah.
How can happen this behavior? Why people want to help, even if you are a stranger?
I think for a lot of us, it's this thing that you're doing, you're like a little expert in it, you know, because it's something that you do and it's important to you. And most of us don't really get recognized for that, those little bits of expertise. You know, if you're perfectly managing getting all your laundry done, or if you're really good at getting emails ready to be sent out to a mailing list, like that's like this little form of expertise where there's a lot of work that's gone into it, but no one ever says like, hey, Marco, you did a great job with the laundry, or like, wow, you know, how do you get those emails queued up so fast and you never make any mistakes? It's like, and so we kind of want that little pat on the back, and getting to talk through our experiences is validating in that way. And then if it's something that we care about, we all, like, everyone loves a life hack. And so just in talking about your experiences, a lot of times people are hoping that I will have something for them. And in fact, a lot of times when someone talks about their experience, they'll be like, what are other people doing? You know, and they kind of lean forward in their seat. Like, if you're talking to me, you must be talking to other people. And like, what are the things that you heard from them? And I almost always do have something I can share that's not, you know, that's not secret or personal. I can say, oh yeah, you know, I talked to five people and here's the thing I'm hearing. And even if it's not a solution, even if it's literally just validating their experience, like we all feel better. If something is frustrating to you and you mention it to your friend and they're like, yeah, whatever, like that feels really crummy. But if you complain about an experience and someone's like, I know, I've had that same experience, it feels good. Like humans, just our brains like soak that up. And so a lot of times that is, it's like that you feel rewarded, you feel validated. Maybe you're going to get a cool trick out of it. Maybe this person's going to build a product that helps you. It just, it feels very positive. It's like buying a little lottery ticket.
So let's say I'm going to start today to interview my customers. Which are the three things I don't have to do? Absolutely. So the three more common mistakes.
Yeah. Okay. So you're talking to someone today. The first mistake is don't feel like you have to have all of your questions written out in advance. Mm. And I think this is a common misunderstanding because a lot of us have experience with sort of traditional usability testing, or we've read books about traditional usability testing. When, you know, at the beginning of my career, if you wanted to see someone use your product, you brought them into a lab with a one, you know, that one-way mirror, and you would watch them click through a prototype, and you had the same prototype for each person because, you know, you only had the lab booked for this many hours and it was expensive. And so you basically were testing the exact same thing, you know, eight times. You know, Jacob Nielsen told us all eight is the magic number that you need to usability test. So we all feel like there's this magic formula. If you try to do that in a customer development interview, I have seen people come in with a list of 10 questions, and then in their mind, they're like, I have to get through these questions. So they'll ask the first one, and the person will start talking, and maybe they're really excited, and they're talking, and they're like, yeah, and this is, and this happens, and this is frustrating, and I really wish this. And the person's like, okay, and my second question, I'm like, no. If you ask one question and someone talks for 20 minutes, that's a perfect interview. That's like you have just unleashed this person's passion and interest. And honestly, if you want to ask the other 10 questions, they will probably get on the phone with you again next week or in 2 weeks because this whole conversation was great. So yeah, mistake number one, don't write all your questions out in advance. Mistake number two is almost in contradiction, which is that it actually is really useful to memorize the first little bit, like just the first couple sentences that you're going to start with. Because unless you talk to people and do interviews all the time, it will feel really awkward the first one time, five times, 27 times. And if you get someone on Zoom and you're looking at them and you're like, hi, how are you today? So I wanted to talk to you about, you will feel flustered. They actually don't care. Like people will think, oh, the other person thinks I'm being unprofessional. They don't actually really notice, but now you feel flustered because you came on and didn't sound confident. And that just makes it harder for you to continue with your conversation. So I recommend people, you know, memorize a little bit like, hi, how are you doing today? Is this still a good time? Again, my name is Cindy, and I'd really love to talk to you about lifting weights and what you find frustrating about it and what you love about it. And if you can deliver that, then you will feel like they know what I'm here to do, and the rest of your conversation goes more smoothly. Yeah. And then I think the third mistake is if you do start talking to someone and they're clearly not really interested, you can just cut them loose. You don't need to keep talking for 20 minutes. You know, you've got someone, they're like, oh, hey, my friend said I should talk to you because I used to lift weights, but actually I hurt my shoulder and I got really into yoga, so I don't really do that anymore, but I have a friend who lifts weights, so maybe I could talk about that. No, you can just be like, okay, you know, I really appreciate your willingness, but I don't want to waste your time. I'd really love to talk to someone who's really experiencing this problem right now. So thank you so much. If you'd love to give me your friend's contact information, I'd appreciate it. But if not, I understand. You know, have a great day.
Cool. And so talking about feeling awkward, because what you were saying before, the thing that made me more like awkward at the beginning is when I read on your book, you have to say nothing for the very first minute. So when I read it, I was like terrified, because you know, when you ask something to someone, it's like, if they don't say anything, you want to jump in and say, you know, while now it's pretty normal because it's gonna be like 5 years. But at the beginning is so strange. I like to say nothing for the first minutes. But what I noticed is that it actually works, because people feel encouraged to talk, to say something. And so how did you come to with this idea of say nothing for 1 minute and just wait, be patient?
You know, I honestly noticed it because when I first started doing customer development interviewing, I was usually taking notes on paper. And so I'd have a notepad and a pen, and the person, I would have, you know, sat down with them and I'd ask something. And as soon as I'd ask that question, I'd start writing down like their name, you know, what I knew about them already. And I was kind of doing that while they were answering. And I noticed that if I had been more organized and I had already written down their name, then, and I interrupted them more quickly, that they didn't talk as much. And so it was really just kind of trial and error. I'm like, oh, that's funny. When I'm running behind and I'm disorganized, and I'm like, so Marco, tell me about how you use mailing list software. And then I would be frantically writing like, okay, Marco met him here, has this job. And so it would take me like 30 seconds to write. And in that time, you would start talking and tell me all this great stuff. But if I had actually came in and I didn't have that time, then people would give me a short answer and I'd be like, okay, great. Let me ask you another question. And I feel like that just sets the tone for, oh, she wants me to give short, concise answers.
Okay. In the book, you wrote something that I think is the, to me, if I to choose just one sentence, is the biggest takeaway, because it had that profound impact on everything I've been doing on product. That is, so the biggest competitor is your actual customer behavior. So you wrote actually their current behavior is your competition. It doesn't matter how effective or ineffective their current behavior seems, but it's what they are accustomed to, and it works, at least to some degree. And I found it so profound and at the same time so frustrating, because when we are trying to build something new, we are like, wow, I'm going to build this CRM, this ERP, this magic software. It's going to be everything for you. And so you don't have to use email and spreadsheet anymore. Mm-hmm. But everyone, so the biggest competitor of Asana is not ClickUp. To me, it's just email and spreadsheet. So this was enlightening to me. And it prevented me to do a lot of mistakes. But it's super hard to get people used to this understanding. Why?
I think in part it's, you know, like you said, we have these big dreams of, I'm going to build this big thing. And it's really exciting to think about how much better something could be. Like, oh, I have this whole solution. It could use this technology. It'll make this faster. And we get kind of caught up in that we don't consider our own behaviors. You know, how many people step over a creaky stair instead of trying to fix it? Or, you know, wedge a folded up paper under the table instead of trying to fix it? It's just like, if something is good enough, we kind of stick with that. You know, or if you get in a rut, you always order the same dish at a restaurant, or you always walk a certain way to work. There's no reason why you have to do that. But it's just our brains think about, there's so many billions of pieces of input flying at us every single day, that if we had to consider every decision, oh, should I walk this way? Maybe I should go down this street. Maybe I should, you know, step up on the curb. Maybe I should go to the left. We'd never get anything done. And so like we really fall into these habits, and that's actually how we work well. But then you think of all this and you think, well, that's just silly. That's irrational. And we think maybe we can get people to behave rationally, which is not going to happen. So it's like, as important as your product is, as awesome as your idea is, it's actually nothing without thinking about that on-ramp of how do we get someone who has a behavior that to them works, even if to us it's deeply flawed. They're like, I'm doing okay. I'm walking to work this way. And get them to consider another behavior. And that is as important as the rest of your product.
Okay. One common thing I'm finding as well is that is the belief that doing customer interviews or talking to people can limit your creativity because you get influenced by what are other people are thinking, and then you're building something that they are asking to you instead of building something that you want to build. That actually is strange, but can you help us to frame this common behavior, especially from people like from stakeholders,
yep,
who don't believe actually in the customer interview tool?
So people, if you let them, will tell you what features to build. They will take out a napkin and draw it. They will tell you, I want exactly this feature that your competitor has. I am not disagreeing with that at all. But if I said, if you let them, which is you learn the more you talk to customers to steer people back away from that very specific feature to what the problem is. So you're right. If you talk to customers and they say, I want this feature, and you build that, you will go down a rat hole. You will never, you know, realize your product vision. So instead, if someone says something like, hey, Cindy, you really need to build this feature, my question would be like, huh, that's interesting. Can you tell me more? How have you used that feature before? You know, and maybe they'll say, well, I used this other product and here's why it was great. Okay, well, what did that allow you to do? Huh. So you don't have it today. What are you doing as a workaround because you don't have it? Okay. And so you want to understand what is the problem they have. If they say, oh, I really want this feature. And you say, you're right, I don't have it. If I did have it, what would it allow you to do? Sometimes they'll just say, well, it would be nice to have. And, you know, as a product builder, we have too many things to work on. We can't work on things that are just nice to have. And sometimes they'll say something like, but your competitor has it. And I'd be like, great. If you use it with our competitor product, what's the benefit you're getting? How is it making your life better? And so what you really want to get to for every feature request is, if you had this, how would it make your life better? Or because you don't have it, what is bad in your life? What are you blocked from? And if you understand that, it's still up to you as the product person to decide, how do I solve this problem? You know, what I've gotten from this person is that they're really frustrated because they always forget things. And they've told me they want this very specific reminder list. But I'm going to ignore that. You know, I'm going to listen to them and sound polite and nod. But what I really want to focus in is, like, let's dig into this. What kinds of things do you lose? Is there a time when you're more likely, like, when is the time that you're more likely to lose things? What goes wrong when you lose something? If you lose something, how do you replace it? Is there ever been a time, you know, tell me about a time when you were able to remember something. What allowed that to happen? And if you take all of those bits, now you have the information that can lead you to building a product. And the feature isn't drawn out. You just understand, aha, this person, they lose small things more often when they're stressed, more often when they're traveling. But the one time that they traveled with their really organized friend, they didn't lose things because that person kept reminding them. And then you take those elements, and it's still a ton of creativity. Take those things and figure out, how do I build something that will solve this problem?
Okay, so basically people are going to tell you specific solutions, specific features. You have to ignore them, but stay...
Find out why.
Exactly. Stay in the present problems, not in the future. That is one
correct,
super enlightening things about your book. Because what I say usually to our students, everyone is in the future is like more healthy, more rich, more... a very like better father or mom. So you have to explore the problem in the present. And one very important trick we read on your book is exploring pain. So the harder the pain, so the more I spending time or money on the pain now, the easiest will be for me in the future to switch to a new solution instead of keeping my current behavior.
Yeah. And it's hard because, again, people will talk about the future. Like, oh, I want to do this. I will do this. And you can acknowledge it. You say, uh-huh, yep, I get it. I'm curious. Let's talk about last week. What happened last week? What happened earlier today? And that's what's more real. The thing that people have done, their behavior, you know, past behavior is the best predictor of future behavior. And so people will tell you all kinds of aspirational things, but you want to dig into that past and you want to dig into, as you said, pain. And I think this is another thing some people struggle with. They say it feels rude. You know, someone will talk about something and you can tell they're getting kind of mad or they're getting kind of embarrassed. And I think our sense of politeness is that we should steer away from that. Right? Because in a normal conversation, if you were talking to, you know, you're talking to a friend at a bar and you ask them something and they tell you that they just broke up with their boyfriend and they look really upset, like it would be really rude if you were like, huh, why'd you break up? What was wrong with him? Did you have a fight? Like, that would be rude. They're upset. Like, change the subject. Like, this is how we behave in normal social situations. But in this one, you've kind of set it up in this artificial, like, we're going to talk about this activity you do. And so when someone says, like, God, I hate using spreadsheets. I feel so dumb. I make mistakes. And then, you know, it messes up my whole formula. And then I feel like my coworkers think I'm incompetent. And you can tell they're getting flustered. This is not when you back off. You actually have to like keep poking at that and say, you know, wow, that sounds awful. Like, when does this happen? When you make a mistake, I'm curious, how long does it take to fix? The last time this happened, how long did it take to fix? Who else had to get involved? And this is where a lot of empathizing is important, because you obviously can't sound like a robot if someone is expressing emotions. Yeah. You can't be like, aha, you were sad. Tell me more about the sadness. You have to say, I get it. I've had experiences like this too. I hate it when that happens. A lot of this kind of padding is very useful to allow people to keep talking and to acknowledge it. And I'll say, like, I don't think it's not right to lead people on, but I've often said, oh, I hear that from other people. I hear that all the time. And that's not leading the witness. That's making people feel safe that they can admit that they make this mistake because they know they're not the only ones.
When can we stop? Because it's a very common question we have all the time. So how many interviews do I need to make? When will I know I will have to stop?
So how many interviews do we have to do? I always say it depends. And also, I think from the time when I wrote this book to now, I think almost everything in the book still stands. One thing that has changed is that the speed of developing continues to get faster. And for those people who it feels like everyone nowadays is trying to build some sort of AI into your product, that model is changing faster. And we're often building things that aren't deterministic. Like what you get back from ChatGPT, you know, it's not the same response every time. And it continues evolving. So the speed of development is so fast that for most people, or not maybe not most people, for an increasing number of people, you're not going to do 20 interviews and then start building. You're going to be doing this in parallel. And so you're kind of doing an interview, you're building a little bit, you're doing an interview, you're building a little bit. At some point, you're interspersing just talking with people about their problems with actually showing them something, whether it's a prototype or actually a little bit of feature that they can use. But in terms of like, when do I know it all? You don't. But there's definitely a front loading to where you get to reach product market fit. And that's when you kind of keep hearing people say the same things. So you're talking to customers, they're expressing the same problems, they're expressing the same, like, if only I had this, I could do this. When you hear the same things over and over, you know, and I think I said in the book five interviews where you've heard basically the same thing, that's a good pattern. That's enough to give you some runway to go build some things. But as you build it, people will continue to, they'll want a new feature. They'll want more capabilities. And most of us who have a feature that's built have this massive backlog of requests. And so customer development can help you still continue to look at that backlog and say, which of these things will get us the greatest boost in usage or retention? And talking to customers about why they want these things can help you reveal that. And then your customer base also evolves over time so that, you know, I mentioned I work on PowerPoint. Talking to people who've been using PowerPoint for 20 years and what they want and what frustrates them is very, very different from talking to high school kids who've just started using PowerPoint. So the expectation is hugely different. And so you think about, you know, what features am I going to build given where my population is likely to go? And if I look at who's going to be my customer in 20 years, you know, that kind of answers that question of who should I be listening to more? And where do I see, not just who should I be listening to more, but like, where is technology going? Like, the trend is towards the complaints that I'm hearing from this set. So you can always do customer development interviewing, but I would say that it stops feeling like, this is a precursor. Like, I have to do this many things to de-risk. And it should just become a habit. And it doesn't always have to be an interview. I think in any conversation with customers, you can ask a couple of, tell me more about this. Or, you know, can you walk me through the last time you used this? And you will always learn new things.
Cool. I have one question from our community. Is a guy working at Fiscozen. Fiscozen is a platform that helps professionals to manage their taxation. And so he said, we have a group of clients we call insiders for interviews/tests. They are users who have explicitly given consent to participate in the insiders program and therefore be subjected to those activities. I would really like to hear your views on this approach, pros and cons of targeting selected subsets of users this way. The name is Alessandro Tezza from Fiscozen.
All right, Alessandro. Insider groups. At Microsoft, we have something called MVPs. A lot of people have kind of like early beta customers. I would say that the advantage of these folks is that they often know your product really well, and they think about it a lot. And so they have very deep questions. And they often also maybe know where trends in the industry are going. And so for asking questions about how are you deeply using this product, you know, if this is something that's very important to you, where do you want it to go next? They often have very strong opinions. So you're going to get this view of someone who's pretty knowledgeable and has very strong opinions. That said, their behavior sometimes doesn't translate to mainstream users. And so I think it's something where you have to think about, is this thing that they're saying, does it seem like they're 6 months ahead of the rest of your customer base, or are they just unusual? So for example, you said taxation, if you had some insiders and they were complaining because they had, and forgive me, I only know about American tax, but it might be very complicated as an American tax customer. If you say had a business, you had multiple properties, you had a bunch of investments of different types, you gave a bunch of charitable donations. You might look at that person and say, okay, does the average American have three houses and a business and these complicated investments? No. Are they ever likely to? No. And so this person's situation is unique. And there are other people like them, but it's never going to be the mainstream. Whereas if you have someone who's doing something, a lot of something, but you think other people are going to catch up. And I think of maybe early adopters, like people who got cell phones early, people who started wearing Google Glass, right? Like, I think some form of augmented reality will come to the mainstream. I don't know when. I think might take a few more years, but just it feels like something that normal people might do as soon as it becomes unobtrusive, as opposed to normal people are never going to have six houses. So I think when you ask questions and you get responses, you can look at that response and say, is this like an extreme version of a normal customer or is it an outlier? And you can choose to disregard certain things like, okay, great. This is a thing that you want. People like you will want this. Also, there's never going to be more than 1% of the population who are people like you. So, you know, maybe I'm not going to ask that. In my current role, when I think about things like app simplicity, like how do I make the application easier to use? I don't tend to ask those questions to our MVPs because they are experts. They know how to do every weird little thing in the product. Ease of use is not really a big concern to them. Things being janky or things being error prone is, but like, how can we make this simpler? Usually implies taking away choice and they want that choice. So that's where I would just say, this is not a question for insiders. This is a question for newer users.
Okay. So, and going beyond customer interviews, that is the subject we talked about during all this chat. What's the most single important thing we can do to increase the possibility of success for our product? So beyond customer interviews and mitigating risk, if you had to do just one more thing.
Just one more thing to increase success. I think it's that on-ramp that I mentioned before, is think about what is the habit that people are likely to have already and how do we make it easy for them to try a new thing? And so a thing that I've heard product people mention before that I've talked about a little bit is like time to value, or like how can we show a little bit of value as quickly as possible? Because that makes people willing to invest more. And I think if we've seen consumer products, we've seen a number of people trying to do things with, you know, first user tours. Some of them are good, a lot of them are bad. But how do we actually give people value? Because, you know, having like a first run experience or a little tour is teaching you something, but it's not actually giving you something. And I think the best example of really quick value is, for anyone who's learned a new programming language, the first exercise that they encourage you to do is hello world. Like get the computer to write back to me hello world. You know, and it's what, two lines of code in any language. But the first time you do it and you see it spit back hello world, it's like, oh, I did something. Like I got that piece of value.
I can code.
I can code, right. I can keep doing this. I'll keep doing the more complex exercises because I've realized that I can input something and the computer will output back what I expected. So how can you do something like that for your product where you give people this value as quickly as possible, where they don't have to learn, they don't have to think, but just boom, they can do something. And I think constantly be thinking about the product as a whole, but also new features. It's like, how can I show someone that this thing will work?
Okay. I have the last question for you, Cindy, is from our community, obviously. If I had to start a new career in like building products, whatever, product manager, product designer, which would be the single most important skill I need to have?
Yeah. Observation. Get really good at watching what's happening. And, you know, if you're going to take it one step further, start making predictions and seeing if they come true. And that doesn't have to be something as formal as a customer development interview or an A/B test, but just think to yourself, you know, I'm looking at this splash screen. I wonder how people will react to it. I think they would scroll down and look at this part, but then close the window and just watch. Does that happen? And wonder why. A story I like to tell is I used to go and work in coffee shops a lot. And I was fascinated by watching people I'd see their laptop and they would open a tab for Gmail and do something and then close it. And then 5 minutes later, they'd open a tab for Gmail again and do something and close it. And I was like, that's amazing. Like, I have 47 million tabs open in my browser, and probably all your listeners do too. But for non-tech mainstream users, there's a really common behavior of having exactly one browser tab open, even if you're going to go back to it every 5 minutes. And I've borne this out when I go to coffee shops and I look at people who, you know, I'm going to stereotype, but they don't look like they work in tech. People will open that Facebook tab or that Gmail tab every 5 minutes and they never keep it open. And that's just fascinating to me. And it's like this reminder of like, aha, like there's lots of behavior patterns in the world. And I need to remember that not everyone thinks like me. So just like the more observation you can do, the better you will be at building, at designing, at coding, because humans are weird. And you just got to watch them to understand the ways in which they're weird.
So you just have to watch my father using computer. He shut down the computer every time you use it. Like, use it for 10 minutes, ask the TV, 10 minutes, then he shut it down. Then he has to use it, like, in 10 minutes, it opens the computer again. So, see, humans are weird. Super weird. So, thank you very much, Cindy. It was a great chat. And we honestly hope to meet you in Italy sometime in the future.
Excellent.
Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Grazie per aver ascoltato questo episodio di Product Heroes. Se l'hai trovato utile, iscriviti su YouTube, Spotify, Apple, Amazon, insomma, dove ascolti i tuoi podcast normalmente. Così non ti perderai neanche un episodio. Prima di andare via, vota con 5 stelline questo podcast o scrivi un commento, una recensione. Questo ci aiuterà a raggiungere sempre più persone e quindi aumentare la diffusione della cultura di prodotto in Italia, che poi è la nostra mission finale. Quindi il podcast è soltanto uno dei tanti modi che Product Heroes utilizza per spingere la cultura di prodotti. Trovi maggiori informazioni e tutte le attività che svolgiamo su productheroes.it. Ciao e alla prossima!